Well, good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this episode this week. We've got a great topic for all of you coming up in this episode, and we'll be getting to that in just a second. But of course, I have to welcome my co-host and cohort in crime here, the Sam Bradley, the very one and only Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
I'm great, Jamie. I always look forward to what you have to describe me every week because it always is something different. Well, we've been a bit warm out here in the West. At least things are starting to cool down. Strange weather across the country this week.
Certainly has been. We're also joined by our good friend, Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe, it's great to, as always, have you here supporting the show and being a part of the show at the same time.
And thank you both, Sam and Jamie. Great to be here again.
So I think I'm going to kick things off because I was traveling this week and I actually had a disaster run-in of my own. And I think that's what we'll be talking about this week is managing travel and what would you do if you had a disaster and you weren't home or you weren't in your normal location where you could respond with your team, but were in a situation where you had to respond on your own or take care of yourself even. And this is what happened. I was recently at the Critical Care Nurses Conference, the NTI conference out in Denver this year. And while we were there, two consecutive days, they had severe thunderstorms, baseball-sized hail, and two tornadoes that were confirmed touched down in the Denver area. In fact, I saw some pretty spectacular photographs of tornado on Twitter while I was there. One, which scared the heck out of me, taken out the window of an airplane over the terminal with a funnel cloud in the background, which, if I'd been trapped in an airplane, would have just freaked me out completely. So that just kind of prefaces things. So here's what happens. I was out there doing interviews for one of my other shows and was interviewing some of the nurses and researchers out at this conference and was down in one of the lower rooms of the convention center, Colorado Convention Center in downtown Denver, when everybody, myself, my cameraman, and the PR person in the room, all of our smartphones went off at the same time with the emergency alert of tornado warning, take shelter now. And we kind of looked at ourselves and we didn't know what to do. And this is where we come into our topic today because I'm becoming a better disaster responder. Of course, I'm an existing first responder. But what was our plan? We didn't really have one. So the PR person actually working for the organization took out her binder that she carried with her. And sure enough, and I was really happy to see this, the organization had set up had pre-planned for this and basically had worked together with the Colorado Convention Center that in the event of some kind of a disaster situation where people had to be evacuated or moved around or something, that they had a plan set up for how it was handled with the pre-plan, using the pre-plan the Colorado Convention Center had set up. And so basically everyone was evacuated from the exhibit hall upstairs down two floors to where we were in the hallway outside the interview room we were set up in. And so that's kind of what happened on one of the days. The other day that the alert came through, but then quickly was called all clear because it was farther to the east of the city, and that's where the storm was headed. So it was away from us by the time they had alerted it that there was a potential for a tornado. But that's kind of the closest I've ever come to an actual tornado. We don't get too many of them in Maryland. When they do hit, they're short-lived creatures that maybe last 60 seconds to a minute, a couple minutes. Just too hilly around here. They get broken up by the terrain, I think. But here out in Denver, in the high plains out there, they were really having an issue with it. And it made me think, you know, I started going through my head, well, what am I going to do if the roof gets torn off the convention center? Now, the good news, maybe, or maybe it's bad news, I was in a building full of several thousand critical care nurses. So if somebody got hurt, somebody was going to get taken care of. So I didn't really worry about that. But I was more concerned, you know, about what kind of devastation. We've seen what tornadoes can do, and a large-scale tornado could take down a pretty large building. So I was wondering how safe I was in this interior room in the basement of a convention center. So that's kind of my story, and I think it's a good place to kick off for talking about it this week, because we've all been traveling in different situations when there's been storms or something going on, and you wonder what could be the next step and how prepared would you really be?
You know, Joe, I got to ask you, and I'm honest, I mean, a lot of my family lives in Denver. So when I first heard that, I went, oh my God. But I don't think it's all that common for that part of the country. Do you think that structurally and in terms of having the right shelters and things, do you think Denver's, is this something they would really be prepared for?
Well, I agree with you, Sam, that tornadoes are not terribly common there, but obviously they're used to fairly heavy construction just because of the snowfall and, you know, ice and, you know, storms in general. So, you know, I don't know how much they have in the way of tornado type shelter, but I would certainly think that the vast majority of their structures are designed to handle large amounts of snowfall and those sort of things. So that would certainly provide you with some protection.
Good point. Jamie, I'm curious too. You said that you all got an alert on your cell phone and your smartphone, and you're all from different places. By what means did that come to you? Through what app or program did that alert you?
It came in the same way like an Amber Alert. I don't know if you've ever gotten an Amber Alert on a cell phone. It actually was sent out, I guess via the local emergency operations center, sent out an alert through the local cell phone carriers. And so it went out, and I didn't think to ask them at the time if they were all on AT&T with me, but you know, odds are we were probably on several different carriers, just because I know for a fact there were other nurses there getting the same alerts that I talked to after the fact. So whatever the case may be, they somehow alerted, and it's nice to know that there is a function to alert people in that way. We all got this alert. My phone did something that it's only ever done when there's been an Amber Alert, where it's vibrated repeatedly for long periods of time to alert me that it was just something different than my normal text alerts or something like that. Joe, you had a comment?
Yeah, Jamie, part of that literally is exactly as you described. That was a federally driven change that was required of the cell phone carriers to have the capability of sending out those kind of emergency alerts to through all the carriers through, you know, MMS or text messaging or something. So in many cases now, if you look on your, look on your smartphones, buried in there someplace is emergency notification capability that allows the cell system, wherever your phone is appearing at the time, to receive those kind of texts. And they're able to do that sort of geographically and that sort of thing, so that whoever's in that geographic area would receive that emergency alert text message.
You know, that just reminded me, Joe, that I hadn't paid much attention to it, but I know that on my iPhone has a government alert switch that you can turn on, which I turned on, and I guess that's maybe where it came from.
That's exactly right, Sam. That's what that's for. And that was, again, driven out of Katrina and, sort of multiple disasters at the time, and a realization on the part of the feds that pretty much everybody's got a cell phone on them all the time. And it's a perfect way to send out emergency alert notifications to a lot of people in a very short area.
And I can read them to you, because I just pulled my phone out and opened it up and went to look at all my notifications in the notification center on my iPhone. And there it is. It says emergency alert 5 days ago. Tornado warning in this area till 3:15 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. Take shelter now. Check local media. National Weather Service.
Wow. That's good to know. That's really good to know.
It's nice to know the system works, though, isn't it?
Yeah, even when you don't even realize it's there.
Well, I think that that's been part of the software updates that have been done to, you know, BlackBerry, iPhone, Verizon, you know, AT&T and others that have incorporated that additional functionality in them as the software was updated.
It kind of makes me wonder what would happen if something like Katrina were to strike now. Would people be better prepared because of notifications like that? You know, it's interesting because I noticed a lot of people the second time there was an alert on the second day, I was upstairs and got the alert, and everyone just kind of looked at their phone and then put it back in their pocket and kept doing what they were doing. Whereas I was heading downstairs.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. I mean, with Katrina, they knew that that storm was coming. With a hurricane, you got a lot more notice, and they chose to not leave. So there's some of that, too. I think mostly it prepares you to be able to take shelter when you know that something is imminent. With Katrina, they just sorely misjudged the power of that storm, I think. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think you're right, Sam. I think that was part of it. That hurricane also strengthened pretty dramatically just prior to landfall, sort of unpredictably. And, you know, clearly there were issues involving responsibilities and responses from local all the way to federal government in regards to that one. So a lot of issues with that one for sure.
Jamie, so I love this story because of all of us, you were the one in that situation. And frankly, I've got to consider how Joe or I might have handled it differently. Maybe not at all. But what are some of the things going through your mind? What were the what ifs? Okay, so what do I do if the roof falls in? So should I let people in the door? Should I open windows or close windows? What kind of things were you thinking?
Well, I was in an interior room, and, you know, I was thinking that, you know, if it looked like the building was coming apart, I was looking around the room for the door, for the doorways, because there were, you know, like most of those meeting rooms in a convention center, there was the main double doors to come into the room. And then at the back on the other side of the room, there was the hallway doors to where the service entrance was, so that people could move tables and chairs in and out through another hallway. And I was looking at that smaller door frame saying, I can get in that doorway because it's smaller, it'll provide me some protection. And then I was thinking, or I could get under a table, and the table would provide me some additional protection from above. But that's what I was thinking about. You know, obviously, if a concrete beam came down, it wasn't no table was going to stop it, but it might stop some smaller debris. Those are the kind of things that were going through my head. Was all right. You know, what am I going to do next? And then I waited it out. I mean, the good thing about a tornado is that it's even in the Midwest, they're at least for a given area, they're relatively short-lived because they move quickly. So I was, you know, that alert came in, and they basically gave us a 15-minute window that said, you know, here's where here's how long you have to worry about this tornado in your area. And so, you know, we were only worried about it for 15 minutes or so, and then it was all clear. I have to wonder. I know, Sam, you were telling us a story, and I was thinking back to Katrina because EMS World Expo, which used to be just EMS Expo, was in New Orleans right prior to that current hurricane hitting. And a lot of EMS responders, paramedics and EMTs, weren't able to get out of town before it hit. And they were stuck in hotels. And you have to think that just because you have a first responder training doesn't mean you have disaster preparedness training. And you're certainly not going to be able to be normally prepared, even if you had that ready.gov kit in your house. It's at home. It's not with you in the hotel room. So then how do you prepare? You don't have any of your normal resources. And, you know, this is one of those things, Joe, I think you guys probably deal with when you're doing your search and rescue. You know, how many people from in a major city or from out of town and don't even have the basic resources that somebody who lives there has?
Well, no doubt about it, Jamie. I mean, that puts you in a significantly different position with only a couple of days of clothing with you and just the bare minimum to get you by. Even if you want to get out of there in many cases, you know, with a short notice event, obviously you don't have a chance to do that. But look at all those people in at Katrina, for example, that, you know, weren't unable to get a flight out of there or transportation out of the city prior to the storm hitting.
Well, but, you know, you got to give first responders credit, as was the case. If I recall correctly, there were six guys from an ambulance company in California who got stuck, but they took action. I mean, that's the kind of people they are. And they said, well, we don't know a lot about, you know, this kind of storm, but we know that it's probably good to get people in a room without windows. And so they herded the people that they could find into this ballroom, and they got through the storm just fine. Then they're thinking, okay, well, what next? Until we figure out what we're going to do, at least we've got the kitchen down there. Well, then they realized that the food service workers had run off with all the food, so that wasn't an option. Fortunately, this was before the levees broke. They weren't even aware that that was coming, and there was these two older women, both of which had cars, that were kind of afraid to go off on their own. So these guys split up and provided security for them and were able to get out of the area, and I think they ended up all in Gulfport, where they hooked up with another same ambulance company operation, and they ended up staying there and working for the next 2 weeks because they sorely needed them. So they had an interesting story to tell, but it does. Now, Jamie, I keep thinking about all your nurses. Yeah, you'd have plenty of help if somebody got injured, but, you know, you have a whole lot of A-type personalities that makes me kind of wonder how that would work if they would all be kind of take action type people. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if that storm had actually hit.
I agree with you. And that's something else that I thought about was, you know, there were thousands of nurses there, and they were well-qualified, highly motivated critical care nurses. So there wouldn't have been a shortage of help in the city if something major had hit and they needed additional, you know, providers or additional healthcare personnel to man the hospitals or whatever. I'm certainly sure there would have been plenty of nurses willing to help out before they got out of town. But this is probably not all as unusual as we think it is. I mean, when Sandy hit, there were a lot of people that couldn't get out of town ahead of that storm. And it struck the East Coast and hit New Jersey and then hit New York City. Certainly there were people traveling and stuck in New York City at the time, and, you know, with similar stories and similar worries and similar concerns. And that was a much longer lived event than, you know, a 15-minute hurricane warning or 15-minute tornado warning. So, and we know the long term effects on power outages and infrastructure and everything else that Hurricane Sandy had on the area.
Joe, you had a thought, didn't you?
I did, Sam, and it kind of goes back to the comment you made a few minutes ago. You know, you have a large gathering of healthcare providers there who are all, you know, very competent and capable in their own areas. Yet there's a lot of variability in those people's response to a sudden situation like a disaster. And I think a lot of that has to do with sort of how much experience you have in those kind of settings and situations. You know, for a lot of folks that have not yet experienced their first real disaster, you tend to get sort of overwhelmed by the drama of it all, for lack of a better word, where, you know, you're seeing the destruction and the challenges that you face with communication and, you know, clean water and food and other stuff, which obviously are incredibly distracting and, while very important, pull you away from your ability to provide patient care and get focused on providing the services that we all do. And so, you know, I think part of what's important for folks as they're preparing themselves for a disaster is some kind of training that incorporates kind of that stress inoculation piece to it, so that they've kind of experienced that drama side of it all and seen that and realized it for what it is, and are able to quickly move past that and engage themselves in taking care of patients or doing whatever it is that you do in your day-to-day work. So, you know, that's part of the value of training and experience in situations like that is that I think it really drives a lot of the value and usefulness of folks who find themselves caught in a situation like that, especially in the area where they are not in their normal environment.
Yeah, stress inoculation. I like that term. I think that's something we should talk more about. But you're reminding me of the fact that first responders will go into action. They'll get through the hard part of it. They weather the storm. And now what? I mean, this is where someone's basic knowledge of now what do? I don't have clean water available. Or how do I know I have clean water available? What's safe to eat? How do I manage everybody else going crazy around me? I mean, there's just... You know, taking Jamie's situation to that what if, you know, what if the tornado had hit the building? And despite the fact there are a lot of nurses that are take care of medical needs, how many of them really know how to weather out maybe 2 or 3 days or more? As they say in California, you're on your own for 72 hours. Not everybody's going to have that level of knowledge, and that will be stressful, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. And you know, we say there's a bunch of critical care nurses there, but it's not like they're sitting there with their ICUs in their back pockets. You know, I mean, they don't even have a stethoscope with them. They're not going to be able to do much more than basic first aid. And you know, so like you said, at least in the initial response, we'd be on our own. Depending on how widespread the tornado would have been or could have been, it may have been a long period of time before first responders from the area could even get to us. You know, there's a lot of things to keep in mind. And like I think I like what Joe said about stress inoculation. And it's one of those things that, you know, is one of the reasons I'm so glad that Joe and Jim and the rest of the folks at Paragon Medical Education Group are associated with this program, because stress inoculation is what a lot of their training is all about, making it as real as possible, teaching those lessons firsthand in an experiential way so that people don't, so people aren't caught unawares when a real disaster strikes and that once in a lifetime thing happens. They've had some experience with dealing with that initial stress and that initial sense of being overwhelmed, and now can push through it and go to the next step. And Joe, you guys do a great job with that.
Well, thanks, Jamie. And I agree completely. You know, I think the other piece of that, another piece of that is now that you're past that initial potential concern for yourself and the building that you're in, had that tornado gone on to cause significant damage in that area, would the folks that you were there in conference with have an idea of how and where they might could go to offer their services and to engage themselves in trying to help folks? You know, I think that's important knowledge as well, that you can sort of go out and do a little bit of that right where you are, of course, but on a more official level, how would you know where to reach out to let the local rescue services know, hey, there's 200 in critical care nurses over here that are happy to go help you. Just tell us how to do it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, I never got that far. I never thought that far ahead. Once you reach a certain point, I'd like to think that I've never wanted to be that guy who self-deploys and puts myself in the way of somebody who's responding in a local area. You know, around here we call them squirrels. They squirrel in on other people's calls and events and things. I've never been that kind of responder. So I would probably stay to the background unless I saw that help was needed once the initial response was over with and we were dealing with some kind of coordinated response from the outside. I'd probably defer to them. You know, notify them that I have a skill. If they need the skills and they need the help, I'm more than willing to help out. But and the same thing, I think, with those nurses there. I think they would have been the same way. Would have many of them would have been say, I can help out. But it's also a unique skill set to deal with that type of response situation. And Joe, you've talked about this before. You know, it's not about it's not all about crush injury. It's not all about major injury. It's the chronic illnesses. It's the little things that are going to cause people the most headaches while they're waiting for the life to get back to normal.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, there are those sort of dramatic and fairly unique injury patterns that we see in disaster medicine a lot. But, you know, in reality, the largest number and the most consumption of resources occurs around patients with a lot of chronic illnesses. And as you get the time element associated with many of these large-scale disasters incorporated in there, those folks run out of medications, they lose refrigeration, they lose environmental controls like air conditioning and refrigeration. And, you know, their oxygen bottle goes empty. And those folks who have and require a pretty substantial healthcare infrastructure to keep them functioning at home quickly lose that infrastructure. And those chronic medical conditions, which were being managed, quickly begin to spiral out of control. So they're, you know, they don't get their insulin, they don't get their diuretics, they don't get their respiratory therapy treatments, et cetera. And those chronic conditions simply all begin to exacerbate. And then those folks are really challenging to take care of out in the field, where you have very few resources to be able to do that. And, you know, no way to sort of continue that, even if you can get it started. It's really challenging to get them managed and back on track.
And Jamie, thinking about your original point about not wanting to be that squirrel, I don't think it would take long for local government to realize there's a great asset pool right here, to the extent that, I mean, just kind of thinking wildly, if some of the local hospital infrastructure was down and the convention center certainly wouldn't be used for conventions during an incident like this, I could see them making that a triage point or something, or utilizing that space with all those people in it to their best good. And I think it wouldn't take long for the local government to realize that you are a resource that they could tap into. So I think you're right in terms of saying, we could put the word out there that we're here and we're willing to help, and then they'll let them decide to what extent you could be utilized and where and how they were going to get you there and some of those logistics. But that was a good point about this would be, if you have that many nurses, how many of them might want to go self-deploy that wouldn't otherwise think about that?
Well, and I know that it's a mantra that you guys keep saying, don't self-deploy. And I've never been somebody who would even consider that that would be a good idea, but I know there are people who do it. And so I'm sure that there are nurses who would do that too, who would go and start trying to do things on their own without knowing that they could connect with infrastructure that's already on hand and perhaps getting in the way. It's an interesting subject to think about, and it didn't occur to me until I was traveling and had to come face to face with this emergency situation.
Well, I think that's the message that we haven't brought up for a while, although we did originally, was in a situation like that, be an asset rather than a hindrance. And we talked about stories like the nurse that went to the Murrah building and ended up dying, and nobody even knew who she was for a while because they didn't have any record of her. So I think it would, like I said, they would find you, and they would definitely utilize that asset if they needed it. But it's better kind of wait for them to come to you. Would you think, Joe?
I would agree. I mean, Jamie was right on the mark, and that is part of what you want to do is let the system know that you're a resource and available, and here's what our capabilities are. And then as the system figures out what it needs, it looks over to the resource column and sees that listed and says, well, look, we got 200 ICU nurses right out there at the convention center. Let's convert that over to a casualty collection point, as you just described, Sam.
Exactly. So I'm curious, too, Joe, would you have a course? Because, you know, when Jamie was talking about the fact that here's these really highly skilled nurses that are used to being in an ICU setting with a lot of equipment and so forth, and it even reminds me when I became a ski patroller and I was doing advanced medical care, but the idea of how do I put on a basic splint if I don't have material? I can use a magazine, I can use a pillow, and sort of that advanced first aid level training was really useful, and like, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that. So even those of us that work at the advanced level of care could benefit by what do you do if when you don't have the kind of equipment that you're used to having. Does Paragon have any sort of classes for that kind of thing?
Well, we do incorporate a lot of that stuff into what we do. You know, there's lots to be learned from the sort of austere medicine, wilderness medicine approaches to things of, you know, literally you can take care of everything you need with a safety pin and some duct tape. But there's also a lot to be learned from, you know, the military side of thing and sort of combat casualty care and many of those sort of more tactical aspects of emergency medicine. So, you know, trying to pull all those different things together to get folks better prepared to sort of think on their feet, to improvise, to maintain a fairly high level of situational awareness and some knowledge of kind of how the system should work, so that they can properly fit themselves into it is a lot of what we focus on.
You know, that could be a fun show, just little tricks that you can do when you only have duct tape and a safety pin. That could be interesting.
I've seen entire lectures based on that.
I think that would be a lot of fun. You know, we could probably sit here and chat, but we're running to the end of our allotted time for this episode. But I think it's something we can definitely revisit again in the future. And we've got some exciting topics for future episodes coming up soon. So we'll have to get into those as well for coming up next week and the week after and so forth. But in the meantime, Joe, if folks want to find out more about what Paragon has to offer and some of the training and education you guys have coming up, where can they find out some more about that?
Well, I'd certainly encourage them to look us up on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group. You can find us on Facebook as well, and Twitter is Paragon Med EDU.
And I'll have links to all that in the show notes, as always. I mean, in fact, because you guys support the show and really are the strong backer behind their program, you go right to the front page. There's a link right there, right as soon as you get to our site at disasterpodcast.com. It'll take you right over to Paragon's page. We really appreciate your support, Joe, and especially your very specific expertise for you and Jim and the rest of the gang. We've really appreciated everything you guys have brought to the table here for the show.
Well, yep. Thank you, Jamie. It's certainly been our pleasure, and we've enjoyed it immensely, and look forward to a long working relationship.
Sam, how about you? Where can folks find you?
Well, in all the usual social media places, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley on 11 on Twitter, and certainly at the disasterpodcast.com website. And in thinking about this subject, Jamie, it would be really cool if some of our listeners would come up on the website and maybe give us some of their stories where they might have been in a similar situation that you were in and what they were thinking and what they might have been able to do. That would be great. And also, we'd love to hear more of what they would like to know about. I was pleased when you said that the crush injury podcast had some great downloads. So it sounds like we have a group out there that's really interested in the clinical medicine. So we'll try to bring more of that out there.
Yeah, we definitely will. But, you know, every episode, if you go down to the bottom, there's a place where you can link and leave a comment. And we'd love to have you leave comments there. Every time you leave a comment, it sends me an email. And so if you want to get in touch with Sam or Joe or me, and just leave a comment there, I'll approve the comment and make sure that it also gets to the appropriate person so they can come over and respond back and leave you a message in reply. So please utilize the resources resources and things over at the Disaster Podcast site. That's what it's there for. We do this show for all of you, and we want to make sure that you're getting what you want out of the program. And the only way we can do that is to for you to tell us what you want more of or less of or want to hear something about. So we'll look forward to hearing from you. Make sure you participate in the community that is the Disaster Podcast. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places, social media-wise. And, of course, you can find all of my shows and programs and the various healthcare space over at MedicCast.com. That's it for me and the rest of the Disaster Podcast team. As we close out this episode, remember, we look forward to hearing from you. Sam, what do we have to say about disaster medicine?
Well, on so many levels, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.